So today we will do the next section of fragments from Heraclitus, translated by William Harris, Professor Emeritus of Middlebury College. Last time we did this section starting his using of the DK ordering section called On the Divine, fragments 61 through 79. And let me just read some of them. And I was also thinking maybe at the end of this long series of talks on Heraclitus, I might just do a reading through from 1 to, 125 of all the fragments, of selected fragments from the first to the last, just so people get a sense of them without my commentary and can reflect, only on the words of Heraclitus without elaboration. But let me do that for a little bit now, the section we just completed on the divine, and then we'll go to the new section called Counsels. That's the translation of the section of fragments starting at number 80. On the divine, 61. Human nature has no real understanding, only the divine nature has it. 62. Man is not rational. There is intelligence only in what encompasses him. 63. What is divine escapes men's notice because of their incredulity, not believing it. 64. Although intimately connected with the Logos, which orders the whole world, men keep setting themselves against it, and the things which they encounter every day seem quite foreign to them. 65. As in the night time a man kindles for himself a light, so when a living man lies down in death with his vision extinguished, he attaches himself to the state of death, even as one who has been awake lies down with his vision extinguished and attaches himself to the state of sleep. 66. Immortals become mortals. Mortals become immortals. They live in each other's death and die in each other's life. 67. There await men after death such things as they neither expect nor have any conception of. 68. They arise into beingness and become guardians of the living and the dead. 69. A man's character is his guardian divinity. 71. The most reliable man understands reliable things and guards them, and justice will overtake fabricators of lies and false witness. 72. Fire, in its progress, will catch all things by surprise and judge them. 73. How can anyone hide from that which never sets? 74. In parentheses, when visitors unexpectedly found Heraclitus warming himself by the cooking fire, he said, "Here too are gods." And that will be all for the brief review of the section on divinity. You can see that Heraclitus, speaking about pretty core notions, birth and death, the cycle or the transit from the living into sleep and the living to the dead, but the dead, are living in another dimension. And that's, of course, the astral plane, and we've talked about that extensively. 69, a man's character is his guardian divinity. And, that's the notion that character makes destiny. And in fact, that was translated in other ways. And, he's very much, he's not only speaking cosmogony or ontology, the nature of being, as eternal flux, as cyclic, as opposites existing in a unified field and a unceasing alternation of these apparent opposites in a unified field run by what we may call fire or strife or conflict, yet that's a form of justice because it's of the logos, what's common to all, and we need to acknowledge and determine our lives in harmony with what's universal, with universal principles. So universal principles pertain not only to a cosmic plan, but also soul evolution and cosmic plan. And so the universal principles that Rob discusses, or Gautama, which is basically the nature of our condition, experiencing impermanence and insubstantiality and dissatisfactoriness, anicca, anatta, dukkha, the three marks, but there is a way out of that. And there is a condition where that has ended. And there is freedom from suffering or freedom from inconstancy and insubstantiality. And that's the goal. And there are principles that may lead us to the goal. And if you want happiness, you ought to know those principles to lead to complete and perfect enlightenment, because moving along the path to that ultimate goal, which is ultimately, realization of the law of one. Return to higher self, complete and perfect enlightenment, complete clearance of lower chakra blockage, and complete activation of higher chakras in balance with coordination with sixth ray and skillful usage of intelligent energy. There is a path, whether we know it or not. And there are principles pertaining to that path, whether we know it or not, such as karma. And Heraclitus, is a straight man and is very, very concerned with speaking principles and saying it like he sees it, telling it like it is, but in the way of wisdom. And wisdom is in great is in short supply now, or in under great attack, with a kind of global war on reason, war on truth, and a war on critical thinking, and mature understanding that's sponsored by Illuminati and all their minions. Now, let's go to the new section where we'll see more of what Heraclitus is saying and his beliefs regarding spiritual principles that are universal for our path, but also the condition of humanity. Fragment 80, page 36 on the PDF. Thinking is common to all. It's common to those of third density and above. It's actually not common among animals and plants, although they have some basic kind of non-self-reflective consciousness, awareness, sentience. Thinking is common to all self-conscious developed beings, third density and above. And interestingly, Mr. Harris has a long commentary after this short fragment 80. Thinking is common to all, and understands, brings in some Buddhism and says to Buddhist thinkers, the above fragment is the familiar Zen topic that Buddha nature is everywhere. That's true. Mind is Buddha is a very famous teaching from Chinese Buddhism, Chinese Chan. Gautama never spoke like that. Mind is Buddha or Buddha is everywhere. He never talked about that. He talked about Nibbana and the extinguishing of desire, ignorance, and suffering. But later monks and thinkers and teachers kind of reified Buddha as Nibbana, the Buddha Gautama or the entity of being of a Buddha is true nature that needs to be, realized as the final goal, which is complete and perfect enlightenment or Nibbana. Gautama himself never spoke that way. Buddha is mind or mind is Buddha. He never talked like that. He was much, much more analytic. Interestingly, Harris also brings in Sri Aurobindo, who was the inspiration for the college, the university where I went, California Institute of Integral Studies. Student Haridas Choudhury, Dr. Choudhury, was a student of Sri Aurobindo. Aurobindo said something. He was an Indian philosopher, a little bit more mental intellectual than yogi, more like Krishnamurti rather than like Ramakrishna. He was more of the Yani yogi or the intellectual type. But very wisely, Aurobindo wrote something like that the problem with the intellect is that that people who use intellect a lot, like we, tend to form a kind of a separate parallel reality of their own beliefs and live in the world of their interpretations, which is an overlay to reality, and often, generally, are seeing their own thought form interpretations based on unrecognized assumptions rather than seeing reality. And Harris also brings in Aristotle and said that Aristotle spoke of Heraclitus often, interestingly, and it was he, Aristotle, who coined the phrase the dark one, and in Greek it is ho skotenos, like me. So ho skotenos, skotenos, that's me, maybe, the dark one. A dark one in this case means obscure, occulted, hidden, not negative. But this is very common, that people who cannot understand something, if they're carrying in a certain type of fear, and that fear gets triggered, may think that the one who is incomprehensible is evil, simply by their own incomprehension, the person's inability to comprehend. And Harris explains and says, but it was the Alexandrian academicians from Alexandria, Egypt, who perpetrated the notion of Heraclitus as an inexplicable mystic, a dealer in uninterpretable riddles. That's because they were in competition. So they don't love truth, they love power. So they attack the man who may draw followers away from their group as an inexplicable mystic, which really means he's not understandable, forget him and come to us. He's dealing in uninterpretable riddles. He's just trying to screw with you. He's beyond understanding. He's just a crank. Don't listen. Come to me, is this type of thinking. Christian apologists, Harris goes on, Christian apologists, meaning Christian apologetics, meaning those who are trying to apologize for their own sins, but actually no, Christians who are talking about, the true understanding of Jesus and Yeshua and New Testament, they derided or scorned his words, which were beyond their range of understanding. This is Harris, but Harris goes on. The post-Renaissance world, in the post-Renaissance world, Heraclitus has exerted a great influence on many fields. And that's very interesting. So Heraclitus has sort of been rediscovered after the Renaissance, or with some kind of a human collective consciousness development that I think, you may call the Age of Reason. Doesn't seem too reasonable, a lot of culture today. But some type of integration of scientism and natural philosophy and ethical, moral philosophy, like the Stoics, or how to live a good life, how to live a better life, the ethics and wisdom teachings and natural philosophy and scientism being linked in the modern mind in ways they weren't 500 and 1,000 plus years ago. And this goes on. 81. Heraclitus, fragment. Men should speak with rational mind and thereby hold strongly to that which is shared in common. as a city holds on to its law, and even more strongly. For even more strongly, all human laws are nourished by the one divine law, which prevails as far as it wishes, suffices for all things, and yet somehow stands above them. So, it's a reminder of Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching, the Tao that is named, or the name that is named, is not the true and authentic Tao or name. The absolute truth that is put into words is no longer an absolute truth. The source of being prior to conception, prior to mind. Mind is a created energy consciousness field of sentient energy or light, multiple structured fields of energy interpenetrating, which vibrate and bear the quality of sentience or consciousness or awareness. This is mind, we may say. This is a created product. It is a fashioning. It's a fashioning of the logos. But prior to that, we have the nature of source, from which issues divine law, which Heraclitus says, you know, nourishes human law, and is the source of human thinking. It's the source of mind, and yet somehow stands above them. You know, source is both the true nature of manifestation. The true nature of all manifestation is its source. Meanwhile, the source is also prior to, as the creative impulse that gave rise to all manifestation, which means all light, all intelligent energy, all galaxies, all came from intelligent infinity, or infinity that had awareness and potency, power to do. It had potential for infinite kinesis. Infinite potential for unlimited kinesis is source, and that source is the true nature of all manifestation, and is immanent, and also stands apart, because its nature is prior to, or causative to, the world of light, intelligent energy, and galaxies, and mind, and conception, and path, and time and space. So men should speak with rational mind and hold strongly, and thereby hold strongly to that which is shared in common. Now, the capacity for reason or critical thought or logic and analysis surely is common to a third density self-consciousness. Yet, we find that people fight each other and disagree and don't seem to want to agree. The reason that they don't agree or can't agree is that they don't want to agree, because agreement is sometimes seen as a defeat. If I say, your thought is wrong, that belief is wrong, and let me show you how, and then it's explicated, and the person says, oh, yes, I see, that belief was mistaken. Generally, it's taken as, I am bad. I'm bad because I had that mistaken view. And if the person loves truth, if you love truth, how much do you love truth? If you love truth, you love its search and acquisition more than you hate the pain of realizing mistakes. More than the pain of a little bruised ego, or a little, there's no ego, but a bruised sense of self. It's called dishonor or, you know, blame and dishonor as the two of the worldly winds, two of the unpleasant worldly winds. the person would need to love the search and the acquisition and the joy of truth, the joy of knowing, without dogmatism, remaining open to whatever is true. The joy of that knowing, the search and the knowing and acquisition and the living dwelling in, the truth shall set you free. The freedom of mind and being that is intrinsic to living in truth or development of wisdom or blue ray. The person would need to love that more than they hate or fear or can't handle blame, self-blame, or dishonor and self-dishonor, the sense of I was wrong, I was mistaken, I was duped, I was lied to and believed the lies, and I was arrogant, and I was dogmatic, and I was rigid. Rare being, rare human, earth human, can move through that and dance happily among the flowers of truth. So, 82. The people should fight for their law as for their city wall. And this, echoes the prior fragment 81, where we're talking about the commendation that men should hold strongly to that which is shared in common, should fight for their law as for their city wall, as a city holds to its law even more strongly, that fighting, that holding close to law, to the city protection, to the protection of the city, which was a big deal, 2,500 years ago and still today. Even more than you defend your town with walls and the social order with law, hopefully reasonable law, not today much reasonable law, even more than that, outer buttressing or bulwark against barbarians at the gate and against disorder or, disorder in the court or chaos among the ranks. Even more strongly than we defend and protect against that, we ought to hold to the common, use reason, be open to truth, whatever it may be, and whoever may speak it. Even a person that's deeply, deeply confused and wounded and hurt, and even delusional, may speak some truth. And a person who, generally holds fast to truth may be mistaken about things, for sure. And so Gautama said, don't follow these teachings because you respect me, or they make sense, or they accord with reason, or they're popular, or lots of people are here following along, but consider them for yourselves. And I think David Icke talks about that, give everyone a listen, and then figure it out yourself. Exactly, absolutely. And that's holding fast to reason with a sincere commitment to truth. And love is universal, and wisdom is universal too. Fourth and fifth rays, blue green, really are transpersonal, in my view. And the seeking of truth, or the commitment to be honest with ourselves, particularly, which is a very deep requirement and ongoing work on the spiritual path, facing the mind honestly, facing mind honestly. That's moving out of the limited, the limited personal separative into the towards the unlimited transpersonal unitive. Of course. 83. Law involves obeying the counsel of one. Paris understands and says this is not advice to follow the orders of the leader, something the Greeks were never inclined to do. And I must congratulate the people of Greece on their no vote to the puppets of the IMF and the fraud, empty suits, guts of the European Commission banking organizations that try to destroy nation by nation by financial criminality. Greece. Democracy is perhaps, hopefully, flourishing in Greece again. And Heraclitus means law, we may say divine law, or accordance with divine law involves obeying, in this case, being in accord with. The Council of One, the Council of One sounds like the Council of Saturn. I don't believe that he means the Council of One autocratic leader. I think he means the Council of the One Logos. What the small, still, silent voice in mind or soul shares or is available within the deep mind, conscience, heart knowing, the counsel of higher self, who lives the law of one and is in the dimension of unity, six chakra related, six dimension, six density. The Council of One, which is CONSEL, like counseling or the advice or wisdom, that comes from the Logos, from the one creator. God is one. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad is a Hebrew. And, God is one, all is one, and one is all. And this is very true. And from meditation and from keen sight, one may know that more. And Heraclitus is basically saying the law of the universe, one ought to hold to even more tightly than one holds to the laws of a city state or a nation, because your destiny, your future, is made by you. And if your actions are out of accord or in conflict with the principles of your path, basically, the principles of one's path, which is generally the positive path, if one's way, one's life, is out of tune, out of alignment, and dissonant, and in discord, conflict with the principles of the positive path, one will suffer more. Of course. 84. One man is worth 10,000 if he is first rate. And Harris says that first rate, quote, first rate, meaning this superior man, is a very rough translation of Aristos, like aristocracy, like Aristotle. Aristos. Aristos, aristocracy. First rate, meaning of the highest ranking. And I don't think that Heraclitus is saying, an aristocrat is worth 10,000 men. What he's really saying is, like the Tao, like the Chinese Confucian I Ching, talking about the superior man. All the time, every single one of the 64 hexagrams is counsel to the superior man. And Lin Chi talked about this from a metaphysical perspective, the true man without rank. And Gong Si, Confucius, talked about this as the man of the gentleman, I forgot the term from the Chinese, but basically the cultured and the cultured true gentleman, the man of civilization. The civilized person, man, woman, gender is not important. The human, the man who is in accord with the principles of a positive spiritual path, particularly sincerity, from the Confucius view, and the superior man, from the I Ching, and the true man without rank, Lin Chi, the man of the way, Zhuangzi. So, this is a counsel to make yourself good, make yourself fine, develop yourself, develop true spiritual aristocracy within yourself, not controlling others, not even in relation to others. Make yourself fine, get yourself out of the mud, this kind of thing. Love your pain and accept responsibility for the life you're living in all ways, although others do what they do, but they're in your life by made by you, brought in by us somehow. Make yourself well and fine, and move to your potential, which is unlimited. And so the first rate man, or the superior man, superior in the sense that they've developed intellect and they develop morality. That's all. They developed awareness, they developed sensitivity, they developed intellect, they developed morality, ethics, wisdom, balance, comprehension. Someone like Bobby Kennedy. Very, very fine soul. Very, very fine soul, Bobby Kennedy. And so, 85. The best of men choose one thing in preference to all else. Immortal glory in preference to mortal good, whereas the masses simply glut themselves like cattle. The best of men choose one thing in preference to all else, and I think there should be a colon here, immortal glory in preference to mortal good, whereas the masses simply glut themselves like cattle. Goyim, Gentile, typical Hebrew slurs, but the notion of beasts on two legs, the notions of humans who've animalized themselves or living semi-animalistic, quasi-animalism, the human civilization's quasi-animalism, is very much in accord with what Ross said as the predominant orange ray condition of blockage of Earth humanity at the present time, while the planet's moving into fourth density, green. Lots of people are dropped down from yellow, third chakra, group concern, social concern, care of right relationship. You know, drop down from yellow ray, third ray, solar plexus center, right relationship, down to obsession or occupy preoccupation with earth and water, first and second chakras element conditions, earth, water, first red. Water or earth, and second, orange water, the personal realm. How I feel about me, how I'm feeling right now, my feeling of this, that, and the other thing, what I like to do, the me generation, or a kind of what I call low IQ narcissism, quasi animal narcissism. It's a pseudo individuality, it's a commercial overlay, brainwashed, pseudo individual honoring. A pseudo autonomy, because actually people are not thinking for themselves. You got to think for yourself, if you want to differentiate your snowflake. So Heraclitus is saying the best of men choose one thing in preference to all else. They have one goal or one preference, which seems to be this next phrase: immortal glory in preference to mortal good. So we've got the Aristos, the superior man of the way, the sincere man, the one of virtue, who chooses immortal glory over mortal good. Immortal glory doesn't mean I want to live forever and I want everyone to glorify me. It actually, I mean, you know, maybe Heraclitus was a clod, but I don't think so. I think what he's saying is, the glory and the gracious, radiant light, love light, wellness of that which persists beyond the body. And this is, I was reading some of the dreaded Frankfurt School philosophers, like Horkheimer, Hork Max, I think Horkheimer. And he's talked about three kinds of reason. Instrumental reason, well, objective reason, subjective reason, and instrumental reason. And a little bit you can consider those the three ways of using wisdom, or three ways of using mind. Objective reason is very much based on appreciation of universal modes of logic and analysis where we. There's an emphasis on the end rather than the means, or the means are selected. How we act and how we use mind is determined by our goals. And that's the case, of course, with instrumental and subjective forms of reason. But in this case, the preference of immortal glory, and I'm not saying Heraclitus has the final word on this, nor do I. Is a form that seeking of what's not simply of this world, not simply of the body, not simply mortal, that arises and passes away in this short lifetime, but that which persists. They say you can't take it with you. Well, what can you take with you? What do you take with you? Do you know what you take with you after the shedding of body, after you drop the corpse? Do you know what you take with you? Well, of course you take your mind. You take the karma you've generated, created in the lifetime. You are the karmic stream that continues after the dropping of the body. And depending on the seeds planted in the life and the way of life, one enters immortal glory or purgatory or Hades. The lower astral, one goes to, whatever the post-incarnative destination may be. The lower realms of woe, like hell realm, lower astral, hungry ghost, wandering around like a fool, or a poor, miserable one. Beware, some of you listening. Good luck, good luck, good luck, surveillance folks. And, or, a very fine future. Walk into the sun. Walk into the realms of love and well-being and joy. You make it yourself. And Heraclius is saying that the best of men, or those who are truly deserving of the term aristocracy, just like Gautama said, those truly deserving the term Brahman are those who've completed the path. The true Brahman is the one who's living in complete and perfect enlightenment with perfect virtue and harmlessness. The true aristos, or aristocracy, is the one who has developed themselves fully, which really means release blockages and balance heart-mind and, being all you can be, the full development of all we are. And that is immortal glory because it is non-mortal. It's transmortal, and it's glory because it is in harmony with the one, with the logos. It's in harmony with the principles of the logos for positive path. Whereas the masses, on the other hand, simply glut themselves like cattle. So that may be common, but we can all make good of ourselves. 86. Gods and men honor those slain in battle. Now, I'm not sure if he really said that, but I would say that gods and men honor the honorable, or honor is deserved by those who act honorably. Meaning, slain in battle, I don't know about, but one can live honorably. They say something like, don't do anything that you wouldn't want someone to see. When you're alone, that holding virtue when you're alone and no one sees you is much harder than holding virtue or being in virtue when people are watching. And, you got to make peace with what you are or what you're doing, whether it's high, low, middle, and some blending. Oh, honor is an important matter. And the positive path is honorable, and integrity and character are key, and that's really, again, development of love wisdom, as always. 87. Even a man who is most in repute, or reputable, knows and maintains only what is reputed, and holds on to that information. But certainly. The justice of dikē, D-I-K-E, certainly the justice of dikē, which really means just universal justice, will apprehend fabricators and false witnesses of lies. There was an earlier fragment that said almost the same thing. Let me see if I can find that. some of these separate, apparently separate fragments, are divided from a single source. 71 said, the most reliable man understands reliable things and guards them. And justice will overtake fabricators of lies and false witnesses. And I talked about that last time. So, those who are reliable because they know how to be reliable. Those who we define a certain way are those who, if it's accurate, those who manifest a certain characteristic or capability. But there's a limit, and there's much to each person that we don't know. so we should take heed before we pronounce judgment. Meanwhile, justice overtakes liars and false witnesses, or those who bear false witness. This is just a kind of thing these Greek philosophers talked about. But it is very true. The universe is just. But like I said before, or maybe I said to someone else, in Gautama's accounting of karma, just a second. Anyway, to go on, 87 saying, even a man who is most in repute knows and maintains only what is reputed and holds on to that information. But certainly, the justice of DK, the goddess of DK, or justice as universal principle, which is the law of karma, will apprehend fabricators and false witnesses of lies, meaning liars and those who bear false witness, liars of all stripe, will be apprehended by justice. But if on the negative path, you know, it's a little different. But generally, the severe liars will come back with some kind of mind damage or damaged mental faculty in a future life if they're on the positive path. That's generally the karmic return for having harmed others' minds through intentional lying and deception, living a life as a lie. My parents are professional liars. It was a famous line from the movie Syriana. Yes, professional liars better make sure they're on the positive path. Otherwise, they will be apprehended by DK. But it is a very subtle point that the people that we respect are respected only as far as you think you know them. And public figures who are lauded by public figures who want you to laud them both often present a false front. And so, I mean, they're the professional liars. And so we should very clearly make a distinction between human law and divine law, between what is of human custom and what is of universal principle on the positive path, which is, you know, principles of the path, positive path, which we do well to know. And certainly, we shouldn't be, we shouldn't assume essence or true nature from appearance only. And we ought to listen to what other people say about other people. But I think it's very important to decide for yourself carefully what you decide or what you consider is true, so you're not taken for a ride. 88. To extinguish hubris, to extinguish hubris is more needed than to extinguish a fire. And hubris is a Greek word, very much so. We still use it today, meaning a kind of overweening pride or arrogance or vanity, self-conceit, big-nosed, big me. I am the center of the universe. In a certain sense, I is the universe, and so all I is the center of all. All is the I, and the I is all, is nothing but the one self, which is no self or universal identity. All is the one, and that one is you too. But how we think of ourselves is a very distorted microcosm of what we really are, or the totality that we are, the universe which it is, Ra's instruction for meditation. Basically, making comfort or making peace with the distortions or conditions of body mind, and then opening to the universe which it is, meaning the adept opens to the universe which it is. Hubris, obviously, is associated with third chakra blockage, so-called ego, big sense, you know, a big sense of little me, a big, thick thought forms associated with me and how important I am, Those people are just fools, of course, but third chakra blockage is very durable and difficult to fully clear. To fully clear yellow ray is really a big job. Meanwhile, hubris or arrogance or unjustified self-appreciation. Self-appreciation that goes into self-aggrandizement, sense of grandiosity, a kind of immature sense of supreme self-importance. This is, common in the world today. Heraclitus is saying that to extinguish that, which is really to clear third chakra, is more important than to extinguish a fire. Yes, indeed, because you will carry that with you. Just like Howard Storm carried with him in his NDE a certain arrogance and a certain weak, frail rigidity of mind, where he thought he knew the score, and he discovered that he didn't, and met the demons of his own unhealed aggression. 89. It is weariness to keep toiling at the same things so that one becomes ruled by them. There's not much to say about that, but it's wearying to keep doing the same work that remains undone or uncompleted, non-completed, unfinished. In a And Heraclitus is saying it's weariness to keep toiling and working, to keep working on or engaged with the same things that haven't been completed or transcended or rightly finished. I don't know if he's saying all that, but I can say it. Surely it is wearying. It's wearying for me to keep talking the same material. But that's why every time I say whatever I say, it's an in the way. Because I don't want to weary teaching the same elementaries. But the linkage that continued toiling, endless toiling, working on the same material, whatever that may be, the same matter, the same work, that is wearying. One then becomes ruled by that, the object of that working. So what one cannot let go of, what one leaves undone, what remains undone, incomplete, half finished, half baked, leads us to be unable to leave it, actually. There's a certain subjugation to the unfinished, a subordination to that which is incomplete, that must be done or that is important to be done. And so that's the case also with incarnative catalyst and lifetimes programming. If you don't learn it now, it'll be presented to you again to learn it then. The learning, of course, is basically the work of clearing lower chakra blockages and developing refinement of love wisdom, which really means acceptance and non-manipulation, seeing as is, or allowing what is as is, and then shining the light of mind to comprehend it in truth, in honesty, in balance and fairness. That's the learning that is the purpose of catalyst in life. Is the development of seven rays, which is the freedom from distortion in mind. To the extent that that remains undone, and major blockages persist multi-incarnationally in the 3D cycle, 3D series for 3D souls and wanderers, to that extent we are somewhat subjugated by the unfinished, by the unhealed blockage. One is further wounded by the unhealed wounding. This is a very big deal. 90, fragment 90. dogs bark at a person whom they do not know. And there's the famous Persian, I believe, saying, the village dogs bark, the caravan passes. Dogs bark, village dogs bark, the caravan passes. And that's a proper attitude we should take to trolls and agents and human negatives that yap and will soon be out of our realm and we'll be out of theirs, and that'll be that. And they'll go on with their activities. Dogs bark at a person whom they do not know. What is he saying here? I don't know. But obviously, there's lots of criticism that people have for each other who where when they don't know each other, you know, or ignorance unaccepted, or the rejection of current unknowing, the rejection of the condition of being unaware, leading to or being a basis of aggression or criticism. Dogs bark at the person whom they do not know. Why do they do that? Well, that's second chakra blockage of animal second density being, or second chakra related, human second chakra related behavior of a second density animal, dog. Why? What's the threat of unfamiliarity? Well, it's just the dog psychology, which seems to find threat within the unfamiliar. Why? It's just a certain kind of it's just the result, I think, of a generalized wariness, where any agent that has sufficient, you know, that has certain power or strength or has some ability to influence us, like what the dog, how the dog sees a human, seeing the human as dangerous, as threatening, because of the power, but also the unfamiliarity. So, unfamiliarity, that which has power, that is unfamiliar, is often seen as a threat. So, dogs bark at the person they don't know, and foolish critics and skeptics, I mean, not all skeptics are foolish, but attack style skeptics and critics, and the argumentative, and the brokenhearted, and the love lost and love lorn, and lonely and sad, may bark and hate that which they don't understand, and that which seems threatening, which is of a certain power. It may not be threatening at all, but they think it is. And you know, we may learn something about lower chakra blockage by understanding animal psychology. That's for sure. 91. 91. What sort of mind or intelligence have they? They, I think he means the crowds of people, the masses. What sort of mind or intelligence have they? They believe popular folk tales and follow the crowd as their teachers, ignoring the adage that the many are bad, the good are few. There you go. And so, wondering what sort of mind or intelligence the masses, Publius, the public in general has, what sort of mind? It's a good question. It's hard for us to know. It's good to know the mind of others. And Heraclitus goes on, they believe, the masses, the general folks, they believe popular folk tales, like what the government tells them, and follow the crowd as their teachers, ignoring the adage, the saying, that the many are bad, the good are few. Of course, in higher dimensions, the good are many, and the bad are few in the positive dimensions. This is what, you know, self-centered, ignorant, arrogant, immature humanity generally is really afraid to realize, is that outside planet Earth, in other worlds, in higher dimensions, throughout the galaxy and all galaxies, the majority of life is of enormous power. The beings, higher dimensional beings, are really powerful compared to us with our limited capabilities, but they're benevolent. They're not ogres. They would like to help as much as possible, and they love God, and they love love, and they love us. And they are not confused, and they're not wounded, and they're not in pain, and they know the score of cosmic plan and the way of soul evolution. They know much, much more than we know. That's not a happy thought for most humans, and so they take the crowd as their teachers. They believe popular folk tales, like Walking on the Moon, or the moon is a satellite. Popular folk tales are many. They follow the crowd as their teachers. That's very, very common. People look to others for guidance, look to what many are doing as to source of guidance. There's a saying in Japan, the standing nail gets hammered. The nail that's standing up off the wood gets hammered down. And that's, I think, a lot of violence in the Japanese national psyche, in favor of subordination of the individual to the group. Harsh conformism as a national ethos. That nail standing up deserves to get hammered down because it should be hammered down like all the other nails, which means you should follow the crowd as your teacher. Meanwhile, there's a high, strong service to self overlordship going on. But there must have been an old saying even at the time of Heraclitus 2,500 years ago: the many are bad, the good are few. And this is just it's a little judgmental and not quite accurate always, precise, but in general, in this world, yes, indeed, most people are not committed to self-development in the way of harmlessness. They're just not. They're not committed to development of the inner. They're committed to temporary grasping onto material and social and physical gain and pleasure and well-being. Nothing wrong with that, but that's where their seeking stops. That's the problem. The seeking stops at the material. 92e. This must have been an addition. Men, Heraclitus says, are deceived in their knowledge of things that are manifest, even as Homer was deceived in knowledge of things that are manifest, who was the wisest of all the Greeks. So some of these here you're going to see as some kind of petty rivalries and sniping and little backstabbing at some other previous Greeks and teachers that he disrespects. 93. Homer deserves to be thrown out of the contests and flogged, and Archilochus too. So he's attacking Homer, who's considered like the father, progenitor of Greek literature and philosophy, even. Certainly important. He's very critical. So he's just, he's just trying to shock people, I think, here. Harris says it may be that Homer was so much a part of everyone's thinking 2,500 years ago that social conservatives could try to refute the oncoming new idea or Heraclitus's ideas by saying that's not in Homer, so it must be some newfangled notion. And so, it's like, where'd you get that from? If it's not from Homer, it can't be right. If it's, there are some people who say, did you read that on the internet? Ooh. So somebody, a member here, just said Homer praised Orion or Orion behavior in his writings. Maybe Heraclitus was making a subtle reference to that. Maybe Heraclitus knew some of the metaphysics or misunderstanding or misdirection of Homer better than we understand it today or than I do. But he's certainly critical of prior traditions that are held as a gold standard beyond, new teachings or deeper understanding that he was trying to present. 94, Hesiod, another poet. Hesiod distinguishes good days and evil days, not knowing that every day is like every other. And so this is anti-superstition. And, in all traditions, there is a conflict between those who are obsessed with portents and signs and omens and sigils and signs in the skies and divination and fortune telling. Unfortunately, a little bit like astrology, people fall into that. They say, "Oh, I'm this way because my moon is in Cancer in the third house, and it's aligned da 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 da," and don't necessarily get to a deeper to deeper levels of comprehending the basis of their distortions or attachments or difficult fate. So Heraclitus certainly was against superstition and superstitious traditions. He was also against considering, that the ancients had the final word, like Homer. Ancients to him, meaning those older than 2,500 years ago. 95. Here's some hardcore talk. 95, Heraclitus. The Ephesians, from where he was from, Ephesus. The Ephesians had better go hang themselves, every man of them, and leave their city to be governed by youngsters, for they have banished Hermodorus, the finest man among them, maybe a friend of his, declaring, quote, "Let us not have anyone among us who excels the rest. There should be such a one, let him go. Should there be such a one, let him go and live elsewhere." So, I don't know who Hermodorus was, but Heraclitus is severely chastising his city folk from Ephesus, saying they ought to go hang themselves, every one of them, because they banished Hermodorus, whoever that was, who Heraclitus says was the finest among them, writing in the fragment that the Ephesians said in their banishing of that person, "Let us not have anyone among us who excels the rest." If there should be such a one, let him go and live elsewhere. This is not unfamiliar to wanderers and those who develop mind or morality, where what appears to be a development of mind and morality is rejected and banished and hated and scorned by the mass, by the group think, by the consensus opinion of group think in any particular group. And thereby humanity rejects what it could learn from, rejects those that may well know better. And of course, as Gautama said, oh, we have a wasp on the window here listening in. Lucky he's on the outside. I think wasps are okay, frankly. And I read a story of a man who, now there's a butterfly next to the wasp. I read a story of a man who basically lived with a big wasp colony in his house and never bit him, and they were all friends and they got along and he talked to them and they listened to him and things. This is bizarre. But Gautama had said, the way, what's the way leading to discernment? Karma. What's the way leading to non-discernment? What's the karma that leads to a mind, a person with a mind that can discern well? What's the karma that leads to a person who enjoys clear discernment or not being surprised and seeing into and being discriminating or assessing and seeing into clearly and deeply, subtly, sensitively? Gautama said that the way that leads to discernment is asking the wise and the worthy, those who know more than we do, for advice and guidance, what ought to be done, what ought not to be done, what leads to my long-term welfare and happiness, and what does not, what's skillful and what's unskillful, what are the principles of development on my path, namely. And so, what knowing, going to the wise and the worthy, those with wisdom and virtue, For instruction or guidance, simply reading or listening or seeking to know, exploring, that is the lead, that's what leads to discernment. And so humanity, on the other hand, to a large extent, feels emotionally threatened by those who know better than they, those who are more virtuous than they. In fact, these days, the Illuminati social engineers capitalize on that very well and have this sort of dissolution, dis dissolving, you know, it's a kind of relativization of morality and intelligence and any quality for human development. Everybody's a hero and everybody's a star and everybody's good, and you know, people we used to call mentally retarded are developmentally challenged. Why don't we just say they are superior, they're superior iconoclasts? Why don't we just say that? Why don't we just call them the brightest, the best among us? So this is a kind of derationalization of culture, of it's an attack on truth, but it's actually an attack on reason. And that's what's going on in the mainstream media. You know, lies are the false is presented as the real, and the real is covered by whole cloth falsehood. And obviously, this tendency of human nature to feel insecure and threatened by somebody who seems to display higher intelligence or understanding or virtue or development, this was going on 2,500 years ago, too. So we can see that human insecurity or low self-esteem as the basis of banishing someone who seems to be wise and worthy, perhaps, why do they hang Yeshua, you know? This human tendency is very deep-rooted. It's been going on a long time. And so it's not only lacking discernment based on unwillingness to submit to or listen to who seems to be more wise than me, who seems to be more virtuous than me, who seems to be more developed than me. You know, I in that camp too. You know, I see those above me, those beyond, far, far more developed than me. Of course, that's why I read these things. That's why I teach. I try to present the teachers, the teachings that I need to learn from. But humanity doesn't really want to do that or offer mind to reception of information or truth or teaching from those who may well be beyond us. And couples that indifference or apathy or rejection with aggression. And that's a big problem. So it's an aggressive rea it's an aggressive reaction against rejection of, banishing of, the wise and the worthy. So if you want to go to hell, that's just the way. 96, Heraclitus hitting hard. May you have plenty of wealth, you men of Ephesus, in order that you may be punished for your evil ways. Actually, this fragment was really, may you have punishment in plenty. May you have wealth and plenty in punishment. May you have wealth and punishment and plenty, you evil men of Ephesus. And so he was really angry. And I don't know really what happened, but, you know, humans who arrogantly banish and harm the virtuous, like the crucifixion of Jesus, like the crucifixion. It's exactly what humans do, generally, often, commonly, historically, not always, but it's pretty common. To those, you know, to those who are of greater intelligence, greater wisdom, greater virtue, greater harmlessness, greater development, greater awareness, greater sensitivity, very common. So, you know, the people who reject, you know, if you spit on angels, not saying I'm an angel, but if you spit on angels, you deserve Gehenna. You deserve the pit. You deserve the pit if you spit on on Love Light. Not saying spit on me. I'm just saying humanity really has harmed the virtuous, of particularly wanderers, over the millennia, or certainly over centuries. Wanderers, it's like what did they do to the scientists who said that the Earth goes around the sun? They do burn them at the stake. They burn the witches. Why? Because they're offering herbal medicine. So humanity, has very much been taught and unquestionably, in many cases, hated and harmed the virtuous that the virtue amidst them, within them. This is a very deep thing, and I don't want to talk more because the time is over, but this is a big deal and has been going on a long time. It's not simply this vast sinkhole of indifference, as Ross said, meaning humans indifferent to spiritual seeking and not polarizing and not getting out of third density for multiple cycles. It's not simply indifference. There's actually some antipathy and hatred and even stimulation of violence or stimulated violence in response and reaction to the presence of those who are more highly developed in mind, intellect, wisdom, discernment, love, kindness, virtue, harmlessness, sensitivity, sentience, awareness, or even helpfulness and goodness. Turning violently against that's a big problem. Anyway, 97, and this is the last for the section. After birth, men have the wish to live and to accept their dooms. Then they leave behind them children to become dooms in their turn. Now, the problem is, what does this word doom mean? Harris says the Old Testament has said that the sins of the father are transferred to the sons in a setting, social setting, by generations. Sometimes that's related to karma. But as we know about the workings of society, blah, 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 blah. I think Heraclitus's term doom means nothing more than dominant pattern, as in greater dooms win greater destinies, which is a previous fragment. And yeah, he's saying always when dealing with Greek texts or any, remember that translated words are only approximations and leave a trail of questions behind. A doom, I don't know again what the Greek was, but if it's dominant pattern, we're really saying that, after people are born, this is one way of reading fragment 97. After birth, after people are born and becoming an adult, men wish to live, of course, and accept their doom, which really means accept their destiny or live their life. And then they die. After they leave, they die. They leave children behind who basically this sort of become dooms in their term, in their turn. Means what? How do you first accept your doom and then your children after you become doom in turn? Obviously, it's not clear to me. But there obviously is a sequence, or there's a link, a chain link. There's a chain of links and a stream of generations from parents to children. We grow up and become parents in turn, and it goes on. Where there is a persistent unwillingness to learn or incapacity to learn, the inability to learn or develop, consistently, let's say, on the positive path, right? The great recycling or non-harvesting of humanity, right? Do you think that how many people you think are going to graduate to 4D positive? 1 out of 20? You see 1 out of 20 people look radiant and heartful. 1 out of 50? Yeah, maybe. 1 out of 50 or look radiant and heartful? Maybe. That's 2%. It's pretty low, 2% of the people are radiant and heartful, which is one way that harvestability appears for those with eyes to see. Why might it be such a low graduation? Meaning so few people are have made themselves capable of entering, the kingdom of love and with love and understanding, fourth density. kingdom of heaven on earth. Why? Well, it's an inability to make use of experience and learn and grow and develop higher qualities. That unwillingness or inability comes from an unwillingness. It comes from actually some voluntary, some volitional rejection, actually, of virtue and wisdom. And that's a problem. It's almost like they don't want to be too virtuous. They don't want to be too intelligent. They don't want to be too wise or discerning. They want to take the crowd as their teachers. And so they take each other as their teachers and keep doing the same thing that the others do because the others do the same thing that they're doing. And that's that. And that's the recipe for 3D repeating. Anyway, next time we will look at the next section called This Paradoxical Universe. Obviously, that's not Heraclitus's self-titled chapter heading, but that's maybe how Harris has titled this next section, Paradoxical Universe. Again, more about ontology, the nature of being, and opposites, and change and flux, beginning with fragment 98. And let me see here. Oh, well, look at that. This must be the last section. So, the last section, starting with fragment 98, goes to 125. I don't think we're going to catch it all next time, but in a couple of classes we can complete it. So we'll do two or three more of these classes on Heraclitus. So thank you very much for listening. I salute you, bold and hardy ones who've heard the whole hour presentation here, and each time, my hat off to you for listening and considering. I hope it's been helpful. I wish you all well, and see you next time, and good night.